96.3 FM, Southside St. Pete's own community radio station, WBPU, Black People United.
It's lit!
When the prison gates fly open, the dragon will emerge. August 21st, 1971, the dragon has come. I said the dragon has come, Mr. George Jackson.
In 1960, when he was 18, he was falsely accused of stealing $70 from a gas station. Though there was evidence of his innocence, he was convinced to plead guilty so he can receive a life sentence. Instead, he was given a once a life, but he served 10 years, and that ain't right. 7.5 was spent in solitary confinement. Label him as a threat because of his movement. Soon, he met Marx, Lenin, and Mao. Black gorilla family, redeem me, how? Studying economics and military ideas. No longer will he fear a revolution was near. In 1970, you wouldn't believe three black inmates killed by OG Miller. Due to the color of their skin, even though they rumbling, it was murder in the end. 3 days later, court ruled in favor, justified homicide. Took away their life, someone had to pay the price. Prison guard John Mills killed for payback. George Jackson, one of the suspects. Angela Davis came to his defense. August 7, 1970, his brother Jonathan wanted to see him free. Walked in the courtroom and took hostages. Attempted to free three other convicts. All had weapons and gave this message. We are revolutionaries. The Soledad brothers must be free. He was only 17, but now he was a man. Hopped in a getaway van. Drove toward the San Quentin sergeant. Police didn't care for the civilians. Shot in the van, killing him and his gunmen. George Jackson was moved to San Quentin. While in prison, he became an instant celebrity due to the release of Soledad brother, but he still had to suffer. Reality, he will never be released. Kill me if you can, not kill me if you please. If I leave alive, I'm leaving nothing behind. They will never count him among the broken men. August 21st, 1971, George Jackson, the dragon has come, but how come? He was assassinated, vindicating comrades for injustice. He was a blatant invoke of fascism, trying to free inmates from a control mechanism called racism. True revolutionary, black militant, Mr. George Jackson. George Jackson, revolutionary. George Jackson, revolutionary. George Jackson, the revolutionary. George Jackson, the revolutionary. George Jackson, the revolutionary.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly Docuvexin. And today is the beginning of Black August, and we're going to have a very exciting show for you today. And Black August, this is Black August, and this is Emancipation Month, and we're going to be speaking to Rupert Charles Lewis, the author of a great book, a biography of Walter Rodney, and also a bunch of great books on Marcus Mosiah Garvey. We're going to be speaking to Rupert Lewis shortly, and then we're going to be speaking with Shaka from the Black August Organizing Committee, and Shaka has been on the show many, many, many times, and Shaka is based in Oaktown, California. We would like to thank two people, like we do every week. Omali Ishitella, who gave us the space on Black Power 96. It wasn't Black Power 96. Then it was Uhuru Radio to do Diasporic Music, Chairman Omali Ishitella, and Archie Shep, who is from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He gave us a concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not over the West. And we are going to be listening to a couple of tracks from Archie Shepp. Archie Shepp has a he has something called the Archie Shepp Attica Blues Big Band. And Archie Shepp was one of the first people to pay tribute to George Jackson. And he re-recorded this song with his big band, a very big band, in Paris, in France. And we're going to listen to a song about George Jackson. And George Jackson, Black August came about as a result of prisoners started Black August in the prison system in California. And it really started in 1979 after the death of Qatari Golden. But we will talk about Black August with Shaka. So now let's listen to two tracks from Archie Shepp. We're going to hear Blues for Brother George Jackson and Cry of My People. Nanga Death, Nanga Death, Wolof, it is the language of the people of Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania, as well as the diaspora of the Wolof speakers. And we just heard Archie Shep's Attica Blues Big Band that was recorded in Paris, France, and he must have had 30 people on stage. You can see that on YouTube. But joining us on the line is Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Mali Dakivexen. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. And all those people who were reveling yesterday, happy Caravana Sunday.
Now, Caravana is controlled by, I guess the Caribbean and African community, that's a long story. We don't have time to go into that, but, they didn't, it used to be called Caravana. We still call it Caravana. The people still call it Caravana. But I think there's a court order where you can't refer to it as Caravana in the press anymore, I believe.
Yeah, no, I believe that since the city took over, there was a sort of a lawsuit and everything, and I think that's settled, and there's So it is now officially the Toronto Caribbean Carnival. Yeah.
And Richard B. Moore, great Barbados-born revolutionary, made the statement that slaves and dogs are named by their masters and free men name themselves. So I guess I'll say that about Caravana and leave it alone. I've always, there was a guy in California whose name I won't mention. He used to use that slogan all the time, but he used to quote everybody, never even take credit for it. I always thought it was his quote, but I found out years later that was a quote made famous by Richard B. Moore. But we're going to be speaking with Rupert Lewis shortly. But before we speak to Rupert Lewis, we want to hear from Sweet Honey in the Rock. And Sweet Honey in the Rock used to do a lot of work for the, they did a benefit for the African People's Socialist Party because Chairman O'Malley told me they did a lot of work with the Sweet Honey in the Rock. And Bernice Regan is the founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock. I think she's from Albany, Georgia. But we're going to listen to two tracks from Sweet Honey. One is called Biko, and then they're going to do a song called If You Had Lived. And they talk about everybody from Harriet Tubman, the Rosenbergs, everybody, Marcus Garvey, George Jackson, Malcolm X, men and women, black and white, and Latino, and it's one of my favorite groups, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and this is Bernice Regan is out front on this song.
Biko, 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 here comes Stephen Biko. Biko, waters of fear and hatred, waters of sobbing babies. Hey, hey, what you gonna do with Biko, Biko, Biko? Come all the way from Cape Town to Wilmington. You can break one human body, I see 10,000 Bikos. Hey, hey, what you gonna do with Biko, 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 Biko? Here comes Stephen Biko.
If you had lived within my vision, would you take the same? You had lived during the days of Neptune. With Harriet Tubman. in the days of Joy Hill, what to say?
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. We just heard from Bernice Regan and Sweet Honey in the Rock. They did If You Had Lived, and they did a song about Biko, and they mentioned the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and we're getting ready to speak with Rupert Charles Lewis, one of the leading authorities on Marcus Garvey. Also, he is he did a great bio on Dr. Walter Rodney, or I should say Walter Anthony Rodney. And we want to welcome you, Rupert Lewis, to Diasporic Music once again. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have you because this is the month of August, and in the Caribbean, there's a whole lot of things taking place, I guess, in Jamaica and in the Caribbean. But I was going to turn it over to Melinda and let her lead the discussion.
I don't know if people don't know, but August 1st was Emancipation Day, and I just wanted to clarify, to follow up Norman, it's actually significant within the British Caribbean. That slavery was abolished on August 1st, 1833, I believe. I wanted to know what is this year's significance of that and moving forward in this climate. What's the significance of, Emancipation Day?
Well, the significance of Emancipation Day is freedom. The freedom that the enslaved were able to achieve, not only or simply through British legislation, but through their struggles. In respect of the struggle for freedom, the Haitian Revolution stands out like no other revolution in the Western Hemisphere. And that Haitian Revolution had a big impact on the Caribbean, including the Spanish-speaking, the English-speaking, all of the islands and enslaved territories in the Caribbean. The Jamaican situation was that the enslaved were enslavers were very frightened at what was happening in Haiti and that it would have an impact on Jamaica. And in Jamaica, in 1831-32, there was a famous Christmas Rebellion, which was in the western side of Jamaica, in which the Baptist deacon, Sam Sharp, led a rebellion. He was subsequently put to death along with many others, and he has become, in the post-independence years in Jamaica, which are the years after 1962, when Jamaica gained independence, a national hero. So that people understand the struggle for emancipation as not simply an act of the British Parliament, but the struggles of the Caribbean people. Significantly, these anniversaries were in our churches, particularly the nonconformist churches, in the Baptist, the Methodist. We are marked by the Kumina and traditional African groups all over the island. And therefore, there was a big, what I would call, civil society and family approach to Emancipation Day. This really had very little to do with the colonial state. After independence, the political leaders in the Caribbean seemed to have forgotten the freedom struggles which led to the region being where it could claim degrees of independence. And I emphasize degrees of independence because I don't think our independence is in the region is fully where it ought to be. So that the issue in the Caribbean was that it took 2 decades of struggle from the 70s, 80s, and then into the 90s before Emancipation Day was recognized as a holiday by the state. So that in examining the way emancipation is marked, a key factor is the extent to which the conscious families in Jamaica or in Guyana or in Barbados, whether or not at the family level and at the community level, these Emancipation Day is still observed, as distinct from the state aspect of it, which is important. But if you only have the state marking the event, you know that the event doesn't have legs to stand up. Fortunately, I still think in the Caribbean region, you do have strong community support and a growing support by the state in terms of institutions which are organized to provide the infrastructure, finance, and so on, so that Emancipation Day can be marked nationally. The Twin Island Republic of Trinidad and Tobago is the territory in which emancipation is best supported. And the Emancipation Support Committee of Trinidad this year marked 25 years of sustained activity. And their focus is not only on August 1st, through from around June straight through to the beginning of August, they organize activities, which activities culminate in a emancipation village in the heart of Port of Spain, where people there are concerts, there is a sale of memorabilia, cultural items. They usually have entertainers coming in from Africa. They have business fora. They have now involved and gotten the private sector companies to ensure that the day is adequately marked by both employers and workers, So
Rupert, sorry, Rupert, I don't want to cut you, but could you talk about the name of the group that kept that going, because they've been around for years and years. Just let people know who the group.
The Emancipation Support Committee is led by the young people from 1970 who made the most significant Black Power Revolution anywhere, whether United States, the Caribbean, anywhere. The Black Power Revolution in Trinidad and Tobago was a revolution which required the involvement of the United States in terms of warships coming in to protect the government of Eric Williams. And after the Black Power Movement, Eric Williams reorganized his programs for the development of Trinidad and Tobago, nationalizing oil companies, taking over foreign-owned banks, a program of nationalization which enabled the state to have the resource base in which to make education and health and other facilities being able to get funding. So that's a kind of short nutshell argument of what the 1970 revolution and its significance in terms of post-colonial development in Trinidad. My friend and colleague, Kafra Kambon, was one of the student leaders in the 1970 revolution in Trinidad, and he continues, and his son is also involved in the Emancipation Support Committee. Now, the situation in Trinidad, where you have half of the population is Indian, half of the population is African. The Indian population, which came later, retained more of their traditions. More of the Hindu traditions, more of the Muslim traditions for people who were Muslims. And the Africans who had been there longer and who in the post-independence years recognized the need for the affirmation of the Black population, they have played a leading role, Kafra Kambon and others, in giving the Emancipation Support Committee in Trinidad its program. And it has had an impact on the region in that people from Barbados, people from Guyana and elsewhere head to Trinidad to witness and participate in some of these activities. One of the last performances some years ago given by Miriam Makeba was at the Emancipation Support Committee activity in Trinidad before she died, the last performance before she passed on. They also pay attention to encouraging the relationship between the African Union and the African diaspora, and usually have somebody from the African Union in dialogue with the government of Trinidad and Tobago. And previous governments in Trinidad and Tobago have also extended. Trinidad has very good expertise in the petroleum industry, and they have assisted some of the African countries who have younger petroleum enterprises in dealing with and negotiating with the foreign multinationals. So aspects of collaboration between Trinidad and Africa and some African countries are more advanced than in the rest of the Caribbean. Let me turn now to the issue of reparations and to a development initiated by the University of the West Indies to mark Emancipation Day observances throughout the Caribbean. The Vice Chancellor, Sir Hilary Beckles, and the Sir is a Barbadian adoption of the British thing, but it's not a British sir, it's a Barbadian sir, just to qualify it, because when you hear sir this and sir that, you think naturally of Britain, where these honors come from. Sir Hilary Beckles, who is Vice Chancellor, announced the establishment of the Center for Reparations Research, which will be housed at the University of West Indies campus in Jamaica. And that center will be led by Professor Vereen Shepherd, who is co-chairperson of the National Council on Reparations in Jamaica. And she is a vice chair of the Caribbean Community Reparations Commission. And this is a body which is to implement the mandate of the 34th meeting of the CARICOM heads of government in 2013, which set up the Caribbean Reparations Group. The Center for Reparations, announced to mark Caribbean emancipation, has four objectives. First, to foster public awareness around the lasting and adverse consequences of European invasion of indigenous people's lands. Because there were people here before the slave trade, and there are people who were the victims of what has amounted to genocide. The second objective of this Center for Reparations Research is to examine African enslavement and colonialism in the Caribbean. Thirdly, to offer practical solutions towards halting and reversing the legacies of such acts. And fourthly, the understanding that these objectives stem from the view that many of the injustices and adverse effects of native genocide, African enslavement, and colonialism in the region did not end with emancipation, neither did the consequences end with independence, and they still need to be addressed. So this is an important development, and Hilary Beckles, the Vice Chancellor, is himself an outstanding advocate of reparations. He's author of the book Britain's Black Debt, Reparations for Slavery and Native Genocide in the Caribbean. And when you consider the fact that he was on a BBC TV documentary, which is being shown, and called Britain's Forgotten Slave Owners. And some of the data and information from that documentary indicates the fact that £20 million were paid to slave owners. That would, according to their research, amount, the compensation would amount to about $17 billion, U.S. dollars. 46,000 claims were made on this money. And most of the slave owners were absentees. 50% of them were people who lived in England. And that 50% who lived comfortably in England pocketed half of the compensation. And 80 of 650 MPs, members of parliament, of the British parliament, were compensated for ownership. So the work on the reparations side, the public work, will be bolstered by a systematic program of research. And Professor Shepherd and Professor Hilary Beckles have partners out of the University of London who also have been doing work on the reparations. And certainly for the British, for Professor Catherine Hall in England, they have gone into details into the 46,000 claims that were made on the $17 billion. And this includes also the church, the Anglican Church in particular. And one also has to recognize that there were some slave owners who were mulattoes and blacks who made claims, but a very small percentage in terms of the overall claim package. So the reparations issue came to the fore as a result of this initiative of the University of the West Indies. But I would be remiss, again, because in not mentioning the work of the Jamaican novelist Erna Broadbent, who has, since over the past 20-odd years, created a space in a rural village in the parish of St. Mary called Woodside. And that space is called Black Space. And what they do at the end of July every year is to commemorate the emancipation using the traditional methods, moving from some of the hidden spaces where the enslaved had to hide on their way to Maronage, on their way to the mountains. And every year she has what she calls a black space discussion, where different sectors of the society congregate to assess where we are today, what's the relevance, what does freedom mean to us in the 21st century. And she's one of our brilliant novelists and what I call black diaspora thinkers and writers and philosophers. And she has preserved this space. And she has written a history of the village, tracing its roots back to the plantation, to the enslaved plantation, and documenting the links between today's population and the ancestors who were enslaved there. She has done marvelous work and written a book on this question. So you do have these initiatives, plus the Baptist Church and some other churches every year have had an annual emancipation lecture. So although most Jamaicans now are watching the World Championship in London, that's taking place, that's where people's attention, they are still the merging of our emancipation with our independence has created a fusion of the two historic moments whenever the annual period of August comes along.
You're listening to, I just wanted to say, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. Sorry for cutting you, Rupert.
Yes, well, let me just say that I mentioned independence, and I want to, before turning to Marcus Garvey's birthday, I'd like to indicate that the Honorable Neville O'Reilly Livingston Bonnyuela has been awarded Jamaica's highest order, the Order of Merit, which is below the Order of National Hero, but it's the highest order for contribution to popular music. Bonnyuela is highly deserving of this national honor. And those of you who follow the Rastafari Millennium Council on Facebook will see him posting his making posts on issues that really matter to many Jamaicans, the issue of ganja and the legalization challenges that we have. We'll see him talking about the way in which the colors and symbols of Rastafari have been appropriated commercially without due regard for the origins of this. And he remains a very strong voice on reparations in Jamaica and a very strong moral presence. So I hail Bonnyuela, one of the three great people in that group with Peter Tosh, Bob Marley, but the one who has survived the longest for the national recognition, because he represents so much of what has been in the both the tradition of Rastafari and positive vibration.
So you're talking about Neville O'Reilly Livingston.
Neville O'Reilly Livingston, Bonnyuela.
Right.
So let me turn to the month of August is really for me Garvey month.
Before you answer the question, let me ask you this: is it possible we're not going to have enough time? We have a few minutes, but could you come back next week and we can continue this discussion? As possible, we have the space. We would love to invite you back.
Yeah, I will be in Johannesburg, so if we make the connection, then, and if the time difference allows, we can work out something. But I'll be in Johannesburg.
All right, okay. That'll be beautiful, but continue. We have about We have about 6 minutes. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Well, you know, this year marks the 130th anniversary of the birth of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. And internationally, there are a number of activities marking this special anniversary. We at the Liberty Hall, which is at 76 King Street in downtown Kingston, have an open house day for Garvey. And we will be launching a journal specially geared to the articles by younger scholars on Marcus Garvey, looking at the movement in an international way, with respect to the United States, with respect to Africa, with respect to the Caribbean, articles representing the geographical dispersion of the Garvey movement, because it's very difficult given the island nationalisms and country nationalisms. Location plays such an important role in people's perception of the black diaspora. Garvey set an example in enabling us to try to come out of our local identities into an understanding of the importance of our global collectivity or global identity. And that, I think, has been the difficulty which Pan-Africanism faces, has faced, particularly in the period with the end of formal colonialism and the continuation of those legacies of divide and rule and separation. So I will be in Fort Lauderdale, the Roots Foundation, led by a number of people in Fort Lauderdale in Florida, have invited me to give the keynote address at their annual Garvey activities. And I will be honored for the contribution that I have made. And I appreciate that, because I just recognize when they asked me that since my days in high school the mid-1960s, which is over 50 years now, I have been either writing on or working on different aspects of the Garvey movement. So I look forward to that event. And in Jamaica, I would say the highlight of the event, there are two major things here. One is the IRFM reggae radio station will be having a colloquium on reparations, which will include a number of people, the Dr. Julius Garvey, son of Marcus Garvey himself, will be there. He's a cardiothoracic and vascular surgeon. You have a documentary film producer of the Hidden Colors and Haiti, Tariq Nasheed. There is an attorney, Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz, President of the Black Lawyers for Justice, the USA, a Senegalese, Prof. Jume Fay, who will be there, a Trinidadian, Felipe Nogueira, and a prominent South African poet, Jessica Mbagini. So there will be a number of these. That will be an attempt or an effort at an international colloquium to bring together people from the United States, from South Africa, from the Caribbean, to forward the struggle on reparations. So that's a major event.
So let me say, Rupert, that we only have like a minute left. I had something to say, but I'll let you finish your thoughts. Sorry.
No, I'm through with my thoughts. So please make your comment.
I just wanted to say Fort Lauderdale, Florida is the birthplace of Archie Shepp, the man who gave the name of the diasporic music. He was the one that gave me the concept of diasporic music, and Archie Shepp has been a man who has, he supported Cuba, you know, when the revolution started. He opposed the war in Vietnam. He always talked about Africa, and he has mentored me. The first time I saw him was in 1967 or 1968 in the Spirit House, in Amiri Baraka's Spirit House. And yeah, so Fort Lauderdale is, that's where he was born.
Well, I really appreciate that linkage, because I have admired artistship, again, reading Amiri Baraka, but also reading what you have written on artistship. So placing him in Fort Lauderdale enables me to add something to what I'm going to say and to listen to his music while I prepare the presentation. So thanks very much for that bit of information.
You know, we just played two tracks by him just before. When you get the copy of the show, you can hear he has a big band, the Attica Big Blues Band, right, which is based in France. He has men, women, mostly Africans from all over the world, as well as a few Europeans that are on the right side of history.
Okay,
so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And we have been listening to Rupert Charles Lewis and Melinda Francis and Lisa Watson's, we're getting ready to pay tribute to another initial man, L.C. Cook. And L.C. Cook was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Black Power, 96.3 FM, Southside St. Pete's own community radio station, WBPU, Black People United.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. My name is Norman Richmond, along with Melinda Francis, and we are paying tribute to L.C. Cook, the younger brother of Sam Cook, who joined the Ancestors on July 21st. And L.C. was 84 years old, and Sam and he both were born in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
I don't know why it should be, but lately I can plainly see you're cool to me. Do what you wanna do, but darling, all I ask of you, put me down easy.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96, and we are paying tribute to L.C. Cook. And we just heard Put Me Down Easy, and that was from the pen of Sam Cooke. And that song also was recorded by Bobby Womack and his brothers. They were known as the Valentinos, and that was a very big song, and recorded by, I guess it wasn't really a big song, but it's one of my favorite songs. And there's a line in there that says, wait another week or two before you tell me we are through, and when you do, treat me as a general as you would a $1 million glass. I mean, Sam Cooke, as they say, yeah, he had some lyrics. And L.C. Cooke was a friend of Uhuru Radio, and he was a friend of Toronto before we were Black Power 96. We were Uhuru Radio, and L.C. Cooke came on Uhuru Radio at least two times, maybe three times. But we're getting ready to listen to L.C. Cooke. And he's L.C. Cooke. We're going to listen to an interview that he did, and he's going to talk about his family, himself, his father, Sam, and it's about 10 minutes long, and you'll get a chance to hear the voice of L.C. Cooke.
Now, what kind of man was your father? Was he strict?
Very, very strict. Very, very firm. And if you stayed in his house, he had certain requirements that you had to do. And if you didn't do them, then you had to get out of his house. Now, you had to go to church. That was the first. It was a must. He didn't leave that up to you whether you want to go or not. You had to go to church in my family. Every member, my oldest to the youngest, had to go to church. And we go to church twice a week. We'd go on Sundays and on a Wednesday. He had high expectations for all his children. Because he thought all of us was great. He didn't think one was no better than nothing. He thought we all had equal opportunity to be just as good as we wanted to be if we apply ourselves to do it. He always told us that, first of all, is how much of yourself are you willing to give to achieve what you want. So you got to give up something. You can't sit back and just worship for something. You got to make an effort. And so with my father, if he made an effort, then he'd go along with that effort, you know. But he didn't want you to just sit back on your laurels and not do nothing.
So whatever you did, be the best?
Be the best. If you're going to sweep a street. He told me, hey, you sweep that street better than anybody out there sweeping. He said, whatever you do, you be the best at it. If you talk, be the best talker. If you're going to sing, be the best singer. And that's the way he taught us. And he always taught us to stick together. He always taught us if somebody jump on one, then they had to jump on the whole family. Well, the singing children, we started singing. It was myself, I was singing bass. My brother Charles was singing lead. My sister Mary was singing lead. Sam was singing tenor. And my other sister Hattie was singing baritone. And that's how we started the group. And Sam always wanted to sing lead, but Charles wouldn't let him because Charles said, you got the best tenor in the world, man. So if you sang lead, who's going to sing tenor, you know? And so Sam never did get a chance to sing lead with the family group, with the singing children. And when he got to sing lead, when he left the singing children, went to the Highway QCs.
And where would the singing children sing? Where would you sing?
We'd sing all over. We'd go out of town. We'd sing. If my father had a revival somewhere, we'd go along. We'd open up. We'd sing for my father. And then we also had a manager. And he would take us around. We used to go, like, Annapolis or Kankakee, Illinois. We just go around saying we made a little money. We didn't make much, but we made a little money.
Amen.
And we was always happy because we was together. My father had a song that he would sing. He had three or four songs he would sing before he would do his sermon on Sundays. And This Little Light of Mine was one of my daddy's favorite songs. So Sam was talking one day, Sam said, Papa, this is a light of mine. I can beat you singing that. Papa said, son, that's my song. He said, I don't care whose song it is. I can beat you singing it, Papa. Papa said, well, okay. So come Sunday, I'll see what you can do. So that Sunday, Papa called Sam up before he did his sermon and said, my son want to sing. And he tell me he can beat me singing this song. So everybody clapped. Sam come up. And Sam was singing. And Sam got ready to get in the house. My father singing. And Sam said, okay, son. You can step back now. Sam said, no, Pop, I'm about to get him. He said, son, you can step back now. He said, I told you, this is my song. This is my pulpit. He said, now you step back. Sam stepped back, and my father took the song and turned out the church. So they had the church. Sam said, Papa, that wasn't right. He said, you know, I was getting ready to get to that house with that song. He said, son, it's my song. He said, I told you. He said, that's my song, and you my son. He said, well, you have to do what I tell you. He said, when you sing my songs, he said, I told you, you have to sing first. And when I get ready to come in, you step back. He said, is that clear? And so Sam said, well, Papa, he said, is that clear? He said, we don't have no more discussion about whose song it is. He said, it's my song, it's my sound. He said, because I'm the cook, and I got the sound, you got the sound for me. And that ended that.
So it was a cook sound.
That's right, it's a cook sound. It's not a Sam Cook sound, it's a cook sound.
Well, how did the audience react to Sam when he was singing lead with the Soul Stirrers?
Oh, man, they loved him. Well, some at first, you know, some people had their little doubts because they were so used to R.E. Harris, because R.E. Harris was such a strong figure in gospel, you know, and he was such a great singer. But what made Sam so different? Sam had plenty of sense, and Sam was smart. When Sam came to the group, he didn't come in singing Harris's song. He come in singing Sam Cooke's song. See, that's what average lead singer make a mistake at. Because if you're going to sing this man's song, all you're going to do is remind the public of R.H. Harris. You're not going to remind him of Sam Cooke. And Sam had the wisdom and the sense enough to see this. So he didn't go in. He didn't sing none of Harris' song. He sung all the songs he sung with the QCs. Just like Jesus Gave Me Why, that was his first hit. First million seller of gospel. Sam had with Jesus Gave Me Why. But that was a song he sung with the QCs. Peace in the Valley. That was a song he sung with the QCs that he brought to the Soul Stirrers. See, Sam came in, like I said, with a different approach from everybody else. See, anybody else would have come in trying to sing Harris's songs, you know. But Sam had the wisdom enough to know. He said, if I only sang Harris's song, Elsie, he said, people will think about Harris. He said, I don't want people to think of Harris. He said, Harris ain't in the group. He said, I'm in the group. He said, I'm trying to make myself popular. He said, so if I sang my own songs, they'll listen to me and think about me. He said, when they go home, they'll be talking about Sam Cooke instead of talking about R.H. Harris, which was very smart. Well, the first Jackie Wilson tour, really Sam wasn't prepared for pop singing at the time. And Jackie Wilson got the best of the tour. He killed Sam. But the last tour that they went on, it was Sam's tour. Sam hired Jackie. So Sam, now Jackie telling me this. Now Jackie was telling me this in Houston, Texas. We was at Wadley's. Wadley used to drive for Sam. Then after Sam died, he started driving for Jackie. So we was at Wadley's mother's house. She had cooked dinner for me and Jackie Wilson. So me and Jackie's at the table eating. Jackie said, Elsie, so you know that first tour went on. I killed Sam. He said, but that last tour, said Sam had me coughing up blood. So I said, what, man? He said, now look, he said, Sam paying me. Said, Sam's tour. So Sam come up to me and said, Jackie, said, when you want to come on? Do you want to come on the first half? You close the first half? Or do you want to close the show, and I close the first half. Jackie said, man, I'm Jackie Wilson. I said, Sam, I close it. Sam said, fine, Jackie. He said, LC, every song that Sam sung was a million seller. He said, Sam was killing me. He said, so when Sam would close the first half, he said, the people was leaving. Said, the people need to stay and hear me. He said, I come to Sam and say, hey, Sam. So we better switch this around, Sam. You better close the show and let me have the first half. Now, Jackie told me this. He said, LC, Sam killed me. He said, I'd be truthful. He said, but the first time, he said, but Sam wasn't ready. He said, he had just left the Soul Stirrers. Said, he just really wasn't prepared. He said, and I killed him on the first tour. He said, for the last tour, he said, Sam had me coughing up blood. He said, I had million sellers, one or two. He said, but every song Sam sung, man, was a million seller. He said, you can't overcome that. He said, there's no way. He said, I don't care who was singing. He said, you can't overcome million sellers, man. He said, and Sam killed him. Sam just had something. Like James Brown once said, Dick Clark, he was on Dick Clark's show on American Bandstand, and Dick Clark asked James Brown, said, what made Sam Cooke so special? So James Brown said, are you kidding? He said, Sam Cooke could stand flat-footed, man, and kill you with one song. So that's what made him special. He said, now, if I could sing half as good as Sam Cooke, he said, I'd quit dancing. See, he never got too big where he thought that, you know, he was well above people. Now, on the same tour that just before we did the Harlem Square, we was in Norfolk, Virginia. Now, we was all shooting dice, me and my brother Charles, King Curtis. And so Sam come in, and Sam broke the game. And so now when Sam broke the game, Sam started giving people money back. He said, man, how much you do? Now, here a cat ain't had $5. Man, I lost $100. Sam gave him $100. I said, man, that man ain't had no $100, Sam. And Sam just giving money. And come find out when he gave up, he ain't have no money. So I said, Sam, man, why would you give all that money up, man? I said, you can get that money to me and Charles. He said, look, he said, them people got families, man. He said, if I take their money, their kids can't eat. He said, nah, I got money. He said, why I'm going to take their little money? He said, no, man. So let them have that little money. And he gave them every penny of their money back. So, see, that was Sam. See, Sam really didn't know the weight that he really carried with people. And I didn't realize how popular he was after his death, to be truthful with you. Like I was at our Jesse Jackson's brother's wedding in Long Beach, California. The table I was sitting at, it was a sergeant of the police department and a lieutenant of the police department. And then there was another couple there. And this fellow was telling me, he said, man, whenever I feel bad, he said, you know what I do? He said, I just go get one of Sam's LP, man. And I put on, he said, and it changed my whole mood. And his wife over there shaking her head. That's right. He sure do. Now, if he in a foul mood, I heard him get one of Sam's records and put on fun. And it changed his whole outlet. So he's a different person after your Sam. So like I said, Sam appealed to everybody. He appealed to the young, to the old, to the women, to the boys, to the girls. Sam had that whole appeal to everyone.
Norman Otis Richmond and Molly Ducky Vexen, Melinda Francis, and we're paying tribute to L.C. Cook. And you just heard L.C. Cook tell his story. And L.C. Cook lived in Chicago. Sam Cooke attempted to get him to move to Los Angeles, California, and he said he never liked Los Angeles. When he was in Los Angeles, he stayed with Jesse Belvin and Jesse Belvin's wife. And Jesse Belvin's wife went to the same high school that I went to, John C. Fremont, and she was killed along with Jesse Belvin. But Jesse Belvin and L.C. were born in 1932. L.C. was born on December 14th, 1932, and Jesse Belvin was born on December 15th, 1932. And we're going to listen to three songs by L.C. Cook. We're going to listen to Gonna have a good time, and this has a little chatter with Sam, and Sam is telling L.C., and he busts out laughing, to say foe and not before, and he says, remember our heritage, and he busts out laughing. Then we're going to hear L.C. Cook with his group, The Magnificents, call a song called I'm Falling, and then we're going to hear a song called Suffering. But let's listen to a little chatter from Sam Cooke and a little Ebonics. Sam Cooke telling his brother to speak some Ebonics.
Sing your soul, LC. This is Let Me. Sing your soul.
One, two. I'm gonna have. Before I leave her.
Don't say before. Okay. Just say before I leave.
All right.
Yeah, you remember our heritage.
Yeah, okay.
I'm gonna have me a good time before I leave away from here. Before I leave away from here, and let me tell you what I'm gonna do.
ever love you. So yes, it's true, I'm falling in a big, big way for you.
Ding dong, ding dong.
Every time you walk by,
ding dong,
baby, you catch my eye.
Ding dong.
Yes, it's true, I'm falling in a big, big way for you.
Ding dong, ding dong.
When I meet my girl, I wanna take her in my arms. But tonight I wanna feel all of many charms. When I hold her in my arms, I'll hear each word she says. I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling. I said, do I love you, honey? You're all I'm dreaming of. For you, my heart is jumping. So let's beat out some love. That's why I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling. And whoa, baby, let's beat out some love. I told you that I loved you and that I would be true. And it's no doubt about it, girl, I really go for you. You know I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling. I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling, 'cause I love you, because you're my desire. And baby, 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 I love you by my mind. You know I love you, I love you, I love you, and it's true. And my, 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 my pretty one, I hope you love me too. That's why I'm falling, I'm falling, I'm falling. I'm falling, baby, I'm falling in a way, big way for you.
Ding dong, ding dong.
Suffering through it all, I'm suffering through it all. When you said you was going away, I didn't know you was leaving to stay. Now I'm suffering through it all, I'm suffering through it all. Just one glance at your smiling face, my heart it wouldn't be so sad. Baby, just one kiss from your tender lips would make my heart feel glad, baby. I know if I hadn't done you wrong, I wouldn't be here by my telephone. Suffering through it all, you got me suffering through it all. Baby, I'm suffering through it all, you got me suffering through it all. But just one glance at your smiling face, my heart it wouldn't be so sad. Baby, just one kiss from your tender lips would make my heart feel glad, baby. I know if I hadn't done you wrong, I wouldn't be here by my telephone. Suffering through it all, you got me suffering through it all. Baby, I'm suffering through it all. Ever since you've been gone, I'm suffering through it all. You know you got me suffering through it all. Ever since you left me, baby, I'm suffering through it all. Come on and keep me from suffering through it all. Don't want to suffer.
Ah, Nanga Death. My name is Norman Richmond, along with Melinda Francis. And Sam Cooke was very close to a man by the name of the Magnificent Montague. And the man, Magnificent Montague was, he managed Elsie Cooke when Elsie Cooke was in the Magnificence. Montague was his manager, and the group was named after Montague. The Magnificence were named after Montague. And Montague was the man who used to be at a place called Dolphins of Hollywood. And Dolphins of Hollywood is around the corner from where the Black Panther Party the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party's office was. It's on Vernon and Central in the heart of the ghetto, and the magnificent Montague was on radio when Los Angeles, the first Los Angeles rebellion took place in 1965, and his cry on his radio show before LA went up in flames was "Burn, Baby, Burn," and he has a book called "Burn, Baby, Burn." But this is the magnificent Montague speaking with Sam Cooke, and I'm sure you find this to be quite, it's kind of hilarious.
Good afternoon, darling. This is Magnificent Montague, and here in the studio we have a man who calls himself Mr. Soul. He claims he's a singer, and he claims he has background that makes him eligible to be a part of your show, darling. His name is Sam Cooke, Mr. Soul.
Well, that's very simple to do, two such a soul for one, Montague. Believe me, very easy to do. But I want to say that knowing you as long as I have, I've had a chance to even sit back and observe you.
Yes, mm-hmm. So you've been, otherwise you've been trying to gather some material for your soul through mine.
I have no retort, no retort for that.
I've been knowing you for some while.
That's true.
And you've always had a tinkling of soul. And I think that this afternoon, we're going to see if you have soul by playing most of your albums you've recorded and singles you have recorded since you have been singing.
Mm-hmm.
I think this goes back to the spiritual day.
That's right, you know, I was with the soul stirring.
That's right, and you know where it is.
I hope so.
Uh-huh. Well, Sam, tell me this. Have you changed any during the years? You look a little older, a little thinner.
Well, no, I haven't changed that much, Montague. I'll say, you know, as a singer grows older, his conception goes a little deeper because he lives life and he understands what he's trying to say a little more. And I think this gives, if a singer tries to find out what's happening in life, it gives him a better insight on telling the story of the song he's trying to sing.
Right. Sam, I'll tell you what I could do. I'd like for you to pick one of your tunes, one of your favorite tunes out, and you recite the first line.
That's fine.
What is your favorite record?
My favorite records is called You Were Made for Me.
What does the first line say?
A fish was made to swim in the ocean. A boat was made to sail on the sea. But sure as there are stars above, you were made for me.
And I can recap that by saying, of all the fish in the ocean, for all the waves on the sea, there's nothing, darling, that I could bait more better than you and me. And if, perchance, I dream, and I being the captain of my ship, I know that wherever I sail, darling, you were made for me. How'd you like that, Sam?
I like that.
You like that, Sam?
You know what I'm going to do? We must get together and collaborate at least once on a song.
That would be terrific. Sam, what's your second best record?
My second best record, my current one, I love this very, very much, called Nothing Can Change This Love.
All right. Now, we'll pretend. Now, you do it like we did before, and I'll see if I come up with something.
All right. This says, if I go a million miles away, I'd write a letter each and every day, because nothing can change the love I have for you.
If I should go beyond the clouds, beyond the world renown, if I should in my sleep stumble out loud, darling, I am not afraid to write your name 1,000 times, for nothing in this crazy world can change my love. I know, thank God, that nothing can change my love for you. Well, Sam, how'd you like that, Sam?
That was nice, Montague.
Oh,
very nice.
Sam.
But, you know, I can't cap that, Montague.
No. I wasn't trying to get you to capture it. I was merely looking at you, trying to observe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to close the show up very nicely, Sam,
mm-hmm.
I would like for you to hum something, just slightly. You hum something for my darlings. In other words, every day I try to describe soul. Maybe you
mm-hmm.
can hum 8 bars of what soul represents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when the humming's over and time finds its soul, all I can say to you, darling, is Sam Cooke's yours. He'll never grow old. Sam, it's been nice.
It's been wonderful.
Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome.
You are listening to Diaspora Music on Black Power 96. My name is Norman Richmond, along with Melinda Francis, and we just heard from O.C. Cook, the brother of Sam Cook, who passed away recently. We paid tribute to him, and O.C. Cook went to Jamaica shortly after Sam Cook was killed, and he did some shows, and he hooked up with Prince Buster. And Prince Buster, for people who don't know it, Prince Buster was a great artist, but he also was the minister of the Nation of Islam in Kingston, Jamaica. He was a Muslim. He was a member of the Nation of Islam, and he had a record store, and he also recorded the song White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell. He reggaeized it. But L.C. Cook joined the ancestors, so we paid. That was our tribute to him. And we're getting ready to speak to Shaka ATN, and before we talk to Shaka, I wanted to just outline something to say that prisoners in California, I wanted Shaka to talk about, you know, give us an outline of Black August in terms of how it started, but before that, I wanted to talk about the fact that Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was in prison, and he was a person who his idols were Dasaline and Dedan Kimathi, and he read C.L.R. James' book, The Black Jacobins, and during that particular period. And I just wanted to let everybody know that the Black prison movement, they were internationalists. They were not narrow nationalists. They knew about the whole world, and George Jackson was the premier internationalist. I'm going to introduce Shaka ATN, Finnan, and Shaka, how have you been doing?
I'm good, holding on, just trying to move this stuff forward.
Well, I wanted you to give us just a thumbnail sketch of how Black August started. And then could you talk about the current situation?
Okay, well, basically, being in prison is a terrible thing for anybody. But for African inmates, you get the brunt of the system, because anytime you try to identify with your roots or your ancestors or any of the things that connect you to something that is considered powerful, you become a threat. Now, when we started reading African history, world history and things like that, we became a focus of the guards. And when we started defending ourselves, it made the terror a little more concentrated. So a lot of people began to be locked in the hole in isolation. People were assassinated for defending people in the courts through the legal system, rallying people to stand strong against the racists and the prison guards, the prison gangs and all these other things. And after a while, it became so terrible that, you know, just living was not a given. Okay, you had no idea if you were going to see the next weekend. So, in 1979, we had come to the point of losing so many people, Comrade George Jackson, Comrade Jonathan Jackson, Comrade Kantari Golden, the brothers in Soledad, that they just opened up and just killed you know, all those brothers in Soledad, just, you know, W.L. Nolan, Cleveland Edwards, Jugs Miller, you know, just on this racist bent that they had gone on. So we needed to get the outside world, the outside community, the news agencies, the organizations that were working on the outside, and around the world to understand what was going on inside these prisons, that we were just not convicts or we were just not criminals, that we were being persecuted specifically. So we came up with Black August as a time to focus all of this energy, to focus all of this this awareness. And we called it Black August because of the people that had perished in that were assassinated. Like Comrade George Jackson was assassinated in August, Jonathan Jackson was assassinated in August, Katari Golden was assassinated in August. So all of these things just culminated in the month. And on the street, we formed the Black August Organizing Committee to work with the community groups and newspapers, news outlets, individuals to spread this word, to shine this light on the prison industrial complex, to shine this light on all of the atrocities that were going on inside the gases, the illegal gases that they were using on us, the beatings with axe handles, they're just straight out setting us up for other racist groups to attack and kill us, you know, to get people to understand that these things were going on. So that was the beginning of Black August. It has now burgeoned to an around the world kind of happening, an awareness where people are doing Black August programs in Honolulu, Hawaii, and Ghana, in South Africa, Brazil, and of all places, Durham, North Carolina, one of the formerly most racist places in the United States. So it has turned into something a little bit different, but, you know, in most cases, people kind of tend to recognize where it came from.
All right, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. You have any questions, Belinda?
Well, I was just wondering when was the period when it started to go international?
Wow, international, probably in the 90s, at the end of the 90s. There was a group in New York called the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. And they had got in contact with me about doing a program in New York that they called Hip Hop Black August.
Right.
And I didn't see a problem. Nobody else saw a problem with it. And what they did was, through hip hop, they took Black August to Cuba, to Brazil, they took it all over the world. They took it to a lot of different places. And that's pretty much how it became international, as far as
through
a
hip-hop.
Through hip hop of all things. It worked out.
Yeah, because we started Black August up here in the 80s, I believe. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had people, because we had interviewed you and Kumasi. Kumasi grew up in the same area that I grew up in, and we had so many people in our neighborhood that went to prison, so we had to relate to Black August.
Yeah, it was the intrinsic understanding.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. In the United States, Black August, it pretty much spread all over during the 80s you know, the early 80s and into the 90s, there was pretty much, the understanding was pretty much everywhere. You didn't have a lot of people commemorating, but people were aware. The commemoration didn't really start and really until the late 90s. You know, when we started a stronger effort to get people to focus on what was going on with the SHU programs, the sensory deprivation units in Pelican Bay and all that kind of stuff that were going on. Because of, you know, all the things that were happening to the families on the street and all the people that were being victimized who were trying to help folks inside, and nobody was paying attention to any of that. So we started another effort, a stronger effort to get that word out, and it just kind of spread. So now, like I say, it's pretty much everywhere. People are trying to say that it's the
SHU? Go ahead. I cut you off. No, go ahead. Finish your thought, then I'll answer the question.
Yeah, some people are trying to equate it to Kwanzaa and Christmas as a yearly event. I don't. You know, it's a different, for us, it's a different significance. So, with Kwanzaa and Christmas, you're more into a celebration. And with Black August, it's a commemoration. So it's a difference where when we started off, we were remembering people that have been assassinated. But now it has morphed into remembering those folks that are still in those concentration camps after 40 and 50 years. There are brothers that are still locked up in there that went in there when they were teenagers, you know, and they're still there, and they're there because of their political beliefs, not because of crimes they've committed. They haven't committed any crimes. They've been locked up. They've been locked down for decades. You know, most of them came out of those SHU programs.
Well, yeah, I think people need to know what is the SHU, two questions. What is the SHU program, and could you talk about the latest moves, how they have shut your Black Office's website down?
Okay, the SHU program, SHU, Security Housing Unit. This is something that up until a few years ago, Pelican Bay was the main security housing unit that housed so-called dissident, rebellious, and uncontrollable inmates, so-called. These were sensory deprivation units where you came out of your cell for 20 minutes every day and you walked around an enclosure that was 20 feet by 20 feet with a 20-foot high ceiling that had a hole cut in the ceiling where you could see some sky. Now, you didn't get sunlight, you didn't get outside air, or no wind or any of that kind of thing. You just, everything that you got was pumped into you, recirculated through machines. And this, you know, it caused so many illnesses and you know, not, especially for Africans, not having sunshine on your skin with melanin, it was very hazardous to the health of the inmates that were locked up in there. And finally, the courts recognized it and shut the SHU program down. After a few years ago, they finally shut the program down and made them start releasing those folks into mainline situations. All over the penal system of nearly 40 prisons in California. You have a few people who are still housed in Pelican Bay, but supposedly they're not housed as security housing unit inmates. They're just simply housed there because there's nowhere else to send them. Just recently, after almost 20 years of having a website dedicated to Black August and the activities of Black August, what's going on inside, what's going on outside related to what's happening inside. Our website was canceled. It was erased from the system because of so-called lack of funds. Now, this is what the web company told us, that they couldn't collect the fee, so they had to erase the website from their system completely. Now, I don't know of any, where else that kind of thing happens, where they just erase it instead of penalizing you or charging you late fees or whatever, and then reinstating your website or whatever. But for us, they erased it completely, and the lack of funds was something that shouldn't have happened, because the fee comes directly out of the bank. The bank automatically pays that fee each month. Every 20 days, the bank pays that fee. And if there's no money in the bank pays it anyway and then charges us a late fee of $35, which, of course, they're going to do because they want that $35. So, plus whatever the fee is. So, for them to say that they couldn't collect the fee is nonsense. They were, we believe, pressured by the California Department of Corrections to end the website, to cancel it. And that's what they did.
Listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96, and so that means you can't. How are you conducting your business now?
Well, we can't really through internet. I have my email, one email through AOL. But we never really conducted, Black August business through AOL. We either went through Facebook or our website. And now the website is canceled. They hacked our accounts on Facebook. They were, putting out phony messages and talking to people crazy on Facebook, and people started responding to me and explaining to me that my site had been hacked, which I didn't know, but they figured it out because of the things that were being said to them or the messages that they were seeing. They knew that we wouldn't be saying those things. So we finally, we canceled the one account, and we did a new password and tried it again, but they hacked into that one again. But that's Facebook. Facebook is easy to hack into because it has to be open for friending people, and the messages and all that kind of has to be more open than things like AOL and that stuff like that. There's more security on the sites that you actually pay for. So with Facebook, we finally had to get off of Facebook, because there was just so much controversy and so many things going on with whoever it was. We believe it was California Department of Corrections, but whoever it was that was hacking into our account and putting out these bogus messages and starting conflicts with people. So we had to leave that alone too. So now we need to reestablish a website, which is going to take a minute, and try to figure out a way of getting back into the flow of, dealing with people on a day-to-day basis.
Melinda, go ahead.
I have
Melinda.
One question. Where did you lose all the information from your website, or was there a backup?
Yes. Yes, they erased everything, which is something I've never heard of. Okay, they erased everything, all pictures, information, every single bit of information they erased immediately. So there's nothing.
I wanted to go back and talk about the whole question of the internationalism, because we had Rupert Lewis on a few moments ago, and Rupert Lewis is a African born in Jamaica who was wrote a great bio of Walter Rodney. He went to Tanzania and he found a letter. No, he found an article that Walter Rodney had put together on George Jackson, talking about, you know, George Jackson. And then you had a man named, controversial guy by the name of Mervyn Dimely. Now, Mervyn Dimely, I grew up in Los Angeles, and Mervyn Dimely was a Trinidadian guy, and he was a congressman, and he was a Indo-African, and my uncle
one of
loved
the first
him.
People that went into the penitentiaries too.
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make. Dimely went into the prisons when George was killed. So I'm going to make that international link. But the whole question of George Jackson and what George Jackson was trying to teach people. George was teaching people, okay, you speak Spanish, you speak Arabic, you speak Chinese, or you learn those languages, and you learn African languages, Swahili, because George, contrary to popular belief, George considered himself an African, and he wanted to live in Tanzania. You know, the whole thing about some people, this guy in California, said that the Panthers, we were black hunkies, basically. We were white boys. But, I mean, George and yourself, Kumasi, you guys were studying African language, and George, Kumasi told me that when you looked at George, he was so much into China, he started looking like he was a Chinese. So could you talk about the whole question of languages and how important languages were for you guys, education and languages were for you guys in prison?
Well, one of the first things that you understand when you start dealing with people of other cultures is how significant the language difference is. In English, once you say a word, the meaning that you portray is pretty much it. In other languages, Spanish, Chinese, the words are so, they encompass so much, and they portray so much. So when you're learning about a people, their language is the best way to understand who they are, what they're about, where they come from, what they're talking about. So we started trying to learn many different languages, but you have to have teachers. And CDC is not going to allow you to learn these things on your own. They're not going to provide teachers, or they never have. And so for Chinese, things like that, we couldn't really learn in prison, because you need somebody there to teach you. So Spanish, we were able to learn Spanish. And one of the best things for us was trying to find something rooted for us. So we couldn't say, let's start trying to speak Nigerian, or let's start trying to speak Ghanaian. So what we did is we used a trade language, which is Swahili. Okay, Swahili is pretty much spoken all over Africa. And it's one of those binding languages that you can get by. Wherever you are in Africa, you could pretty much get by if you have a basic knowledge of Swahili. So we required that everybody learn to speak Swahili, which is pretty much what happened. And, of course, as is their nature, the CDC came down on us. They destroyed all of our Swahili books, any information that we had on Swahili, and they made it illegal for us to teach one another Swahili or speak the language in prison. So anytime anyone was heard speaking Swahili, they were punished. Now, you could speak Spanish. If you were able to, you could walk up and down the hallway speaking Chinese. That was wonderful. You know, it was okay. If you could get everybody to understand Chinese, that way it wouldn't have been a problem. But Swahili was, like I said, it was a trade language, so they felt really threatened by us learning it because they felt like it pulled us together tribally, okay, which is, you know, they really didn't want that. To this day, you cannot speak Swahili in prison. You can't learn it. You can't have Swahili books. And it's right now today, it's illegal, and you get punished for it. You know, you can do – here's a thing that's really strange. You can go to the prison library right now if you're a white guy or Mexican or anybody, and you can walk up to the shelf and pull down a copy of Blood in My Eye or Soledad Brothers and read it to your heart's content, okay? But if you are an African and you walk into that library and do the same thing, you get punished. Okay, but that book, those books are available in the prison library, which is amazing. So, and you get punished. You bet not have it in your cell. You cannot have a picture of George in your cell, Jonathan in your cell. You can't have any information on Black August in your cell. All of that you get punished for.
Shaka, we only have like a couple of minutes. I'd like you, what can people do and how can they hook up with the Black August Organizing Committee?
Well, the best way now is just to write to us. We still have a post office box, 1714 Franklin Street, box number 100-309, Oakland, California, 94612. That's still there. They haven't been able to erase it. They keep going up on the funds, but they haven't been able to erase that. But as far as commemorating, you know, we ask people the usual stuff: eat one meal a day after sunset, drink only water until after sunset, work out, exercise, no drugs, no alcohol. Do not patronize fast foods, you know, McDonald's and all them other places like that. Eat fresh vegetables. Study. Abstain from negative influences. Resist temptation in yourself. Make a conscious effort to abstain from all negativity in thought and deed. Just do those things that you know will help your community and try to find ways of rooting out the things that are destructive to our community. Now, we know that as far as Black August and the things that are concentrated in Black August, the main thing is family and community. So do those things that will help you to strengthen your family. That will help you strengthen your community. And Black August Resistance is in step with that.
All right, sir. Thank you. And we will be in touch, and we will post this information on Facebook and on Twitter to spread this particular interview, and the people can get a hold of you. Do you want to give out your email address or keep that under wraps?
Yeah, you can give out the email address. You have it, right?
Yes, sir. You can give it out now.
RoyBomba@AOL.com. That's ROYB as in boy, OOMB as in